You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, candy won, candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Many storms can form an arch.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local 41 and United Auto Workers Local 31. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. And Buy American, Keep America Working, United Auto Workers, Local 31. We build the Chevy Malibu and the Buick LaCrosse at the GM Fairfax plant. What you drive drives America. We thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, in the 1970s, there was a huge effort to pass an equal rights amendment for women to the Constitution. It narrowly failed, and Jessica Neuwirth says it's time to bring back the ERA. Find out why on tonight's show. Then, why is Kansas City School Board sponsoring a charter school? And is this just sneaky privatization? In the news, is the Pope a socialist? What's in the proposed United Auto Worker Fiat Chrysler contract? And our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. Now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, September 24, 2015. Last Wednesday, while Missouri lawmakers were protecting the working poor from a threat of a higher minimum wage, the U.S. Census Bureau released its annual report on health insurance coverage. Overall, there's a significant improvement. The number of uninsured Americans dropped by 9 million, 8.4% of the population, down from 13.3% in 2013. That Obamacare has brought coverage to a significant number of uninsured is indisputable. When it was passed in 2010, 16.2% of Americans had no insurance. But those benefits don't extend to Missouri, where kids are twice as likely to be uninsured as kids in neighboring Illinois. That's because Missouri failed to expand Medicaid coverage. Under Obamacare, they were supposed to extend Medicaid to all families making less than 200% of the poverty line. In Missouri, 11.3% of the children in those families were uninsured last year. That compares with 8.6% nationwide and only 4.7% in Illinois. Consequently, 70,000 Missouri kids are without health insurance. This is true even though children in families making less than 200% of the poverty line are supposed to get CHIPS, the Child Health Insurance Program. The St. Louis Post says that when parents can't get insurance, they often don't bother getting it for their kids. With all the cutbacks at the Missouri Department of Social Services, for those who try to sign up, there are no long lines and fewer people to help them enroll.
Labor Notes reports that after a five-day strike, Seattle teachers returned to work on September 16th as they reviewed their tentative agreement. While some members were disappointed that wage increases were not higher, they won on other important issues, including evaluations. Contentious issues were teacher pay, concessions demanded by the district, such as lengthening the school day without compensation, and union proposals to guarantee recess and curb standardized testing. The settlement includes raises of 3%, 2%, and 4.5% over 3 years. Members will also get a 4.5% cost of living increase from the state. The Seattle Education Association succeeded in removing standardized test results from teacher evaluations and in establishing caseload caps for nurses and counselors. The district was able to lengthen the school day by 20 minutes. The longer day will go into effect the third year, and teachers will be compensated with additional funds generated by a local tech tax. In a far from unanimous vote, the SEA Executive Board recommended the settlement 17 votes to 5, and 60% of the delegate assembly voted yes. Then last Sunday, more than 3,000 teachers and other school employees voted overwhelmingly to approve the three-year contract. A bargaining committee member, Andy Russell, an elementary school teacher, was on the picket line the first 3 days of the strike when no negotiations took place. "The spirit was amazing," he said. "We had no idea it was going to be as great as it was," Russell said. He said that on one day, 95% of members were picketing, and by day two, it was 97%, on top of community support. "Parents were coming out of the woodwork. We had students there," he said.
Pope Francis spoke to Congress today and gave them an earful about welcoming migrants. That's not the only thing that the Pope thinks that might not sit well with everyone. From the middle to the right of the political spectrum, Harold Meyerson, a very sympathetic journalist to working people, wrote the following in yesterday's Washington Post. "In place of our current system, Francis has recommended giving workers more power, in particular promoting worker-owned and run cooperatives. Speaking to delegation from Italian cooperatives, he extolled an authentic, true cooperative where capital does not have command over men, but men over capital. As Nathan Schneider has pointed out in an article in The Nation, the church has a rich history of supporting working co-ops, including the Mondragon Corporation in Spain, which is the largest co-op and which was founded by a priest. The U.S. Conference of Bishops Catholic Campaign for Human Development is a major funder of worker co-ops. On the U.S. political spectrum, this kind of advocacy for worker-controlled plunks you down firmly on the left. Indeed, the primary author of legislation that would promote worker co-ops, if Congress ever sought fit to pass, is one of Bernie Sanders. But Francis' critiques of capitalism aren't peculiar for the left wing of the church. On the contrary, they echo the encyclicals of his predecessors, Popes Benedict, John Paul II, all the way back to Pope Leo in the 1890s, in favor of unions against the sway that capital holds over nations and peoples.
We're seeing lots of protests from workers at Fiat Chrysler and other auto workers over the proposed contract hashed out last week and destined, if approved, to be the pattern for GM and Ford. So we thought we'd give you some highlights. The tentative four-year contract, which if approved would cover 36,000 workers, attacks the big issue, two-tier wages, imposed during the Great Recession supposedly as a temporary measure while the automakers were in dire straits. The new agreement features gradual elimination of the gap between senior and junior employee wages. The proposal gives more veteran Tier 1 workers raises of 3% on ratification and again in September 2017, plus 4% lump sum bonuses in the PAC's second and fourth years. But there's criticism coming that Tier 1 workers' pay would essentially stay flat, even after a decade of no raises at all. Tier 1 workers now get around $28 hourly. Tier 2 workers will start at $17 an hour, a contract summary says. Tier 2 workers' wages would rise to a maximum of $25.35 an hour after 7 years. By the end of the contract, new hires in 2015 will rise to $22 an hour, with other workers rising to $23 or $24 an hour. All workers will also get a $3,000 signing bonus if the pact is ratified. Tier 2 covers about 45% of Fiat Chrysler workers. The other big change in the contract involves health insurance. The proposal wants Fiat Chrysler and the UAW to set up a version of the Voluntary Employee Benefits Agreement, VEBA, the Detroit 3 and the UAW created after the Great Recession hit. The VEBA covers retirees and the UAW runs it. with the automakers funding it through a complicated stock arrangement. Williams, in his cover letter, says the union wants to extend the VEBA to workers at Ford and GM too, producing a larger pool of workers and economies of scale the union can use in negotiating health care costs. Another big issue is the proposal to move all car production by Fiat Chrysler to Mexico, where they can make a bigger profit while transferring some truck production to the U.S., where profits are good. That will mean a lot of dislocations of workers having to move from one plant to another. Not exactly a happy prospect for people who may have already been transferred because of plant closings. Dissidents are urging a no vote against the pact. One of them told PAI News Service, both Fiat Chrysler and the UAW are working to create even more divisions between workers within the plants, pitting young against old in a drive to increase productivity through relentless speed-ups. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Jen Zaman, Alex Bisges, and Ariana Eckel.
Nine times six, 54. Schools getting closed like never before. It's the most school closings in history, but it ain't no Scooby-Doo mystery. Gonna clear out the neighborhood, keep people moving out to Harvey and Maywood. Ripping out community anchors, push out the poor kids, bring on the bankers. Where was Rom when the deal got done?
Out skiing in the Utah sun.
These are your schools, Chicago, and it's time to stand up.
You got to stand up, show them who you are. It's time to fight back, Rahm has gone too far.
Progressive poser, walking bulldozer, union busting, grade school closer. 9.5, landed a quick jab, south side, west side, it's a land grab. Looking for a tax base, maybe a white face, all out crisis that he won't let go to waste. Running schools with the help of the fat cats, treating poor kids like they were lab rats. These are your schools, Chicago, tell them what to do, G.
You got to stand up, show them who you are.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Lon Swearingen. The intro tonight was Time to Fight Back. Our guest is Carl Peterson. The program tonight is about charter schools. We're doing this program because of the vote taken at the Kansas City School Board meeting on August 26, 2015. With a 5-3 vote, the school board has given permission to have the school district sponsor a charter school. Most definitions of a charter school are saying charter schools are public schools. My opinion is that they are private schools funded by taxpayer money with huge outside donations and controlled by its own board, generally without public input. With that, I'm concerned about the privatization of public education. What I'm saying is that we've always had private schools, parochial schools, and in-home schooling that didn't take any taxpayer money. We now have charter school corporations that are taking taxpayer money away from an already underfunded public education. Remember the last time it was checked, charter schools had an 87% failure rate in Kansas City. Now let us look at a little history of charter schools in Kansas City. With the passage of No Child Left Behind, that started the charter school movement. Something like 16 to 17 years ago, the first charter school was started in Kansas City. Then the major movement started with the passage of the education bill known as Race to the Top. And with that bill, the number of charter schools and charter school corporations had really growth in around 2012. And in 2014, there was a plan to have CE Trust, a national charter corporation, take over the Kansas City, Missouri School District by the Missouri Department of Education and Elementary and Secondary Education. This was one of the first times that the pushback on a charter school corporation happened before they implemented is charter schools. It was blocked by the district, the teachers union, the parents, and the community coming together. Now in 2015, there are two charter issues happening. One, there is an invitation that had the citizens of the World Charter Schools Corporation come to talk to the Kansas City School District by a number of parents. As that was going on, the Urban Neighborhood Initiative came with a charter school named the Kansas City Neighborhood Academy. And what they were asking was to have the Kansas City School District sponsor the Kansas City Neighborhood Charter School. The school board voted to sponsor the charter school, and in my opinion, I feel that this is a direct step in the direction of privatizing the Kansas City School District. So I asked some school board members if they would let me interview them about the sponsorship of the charter school, and was told that in the school board policy, they really shouldn't do that. I contacted Carl Peterson, former school board president of the Ferguson-Florissant School District. Currently, Carl is new president of the statewide group Missouri Advocates for Public Schools. Tell us about your background.
My background is really in the private sector. I'm an industrial engineer by background, and I was a plant manager, but I manage plants down in the lower economic areas of St. Louis, and so became familiar with that. Then I went on to become the board president of the Ferguson-Florissant School District. My wife is a teacher in Ferguson-Florissant, and then I've been involved in various organizations that have promoted public schools, Save Our Schools, SOS being one of them, and I'm currently the president of Missouri Public School Advocates. So, you know, that's what I've done over the last few years, is speak out on behalf of public schools, and would appreciate the time to speak out some more.
So what would be the actual definition of a charter school?
Well, a charter school is really a school that is, I don't want to say licensed by the state, but it is permitted by the state to exist in school districts that are unaccredited, and they're actually public schools, but they're run by private firms. Sometimes it's a national consortium. Most of the schools, about 70% of them, are run by consortiums that have 10 or more schools. And they get public money to run those schools. It isn't financed by private money, but they have the right to hire whoever they want to, whether or not they're qualified, whether or not they have any certification in teaching. And they sort of run their own show their own way, and that supposedly gives them some one-upsmanship over the public schools, but I think experience has shown not really.
Okay. How are charter schools funded then, other than the tax money? Do they get more money from somewhere else?
They can. You know, it isn't like that some people can't donate to them, and I'm sure that they do, but the vast, vast majority of that money simply comes from the, if a student is getting, say, $11,000 a year, which is the Missouri average, for going to school in a public school, then if they switch over to the charter school, that $11,000 basically goes with the child.
And then what has been the effect of the opening of multiple charter schools on urban school districts, such as where you're at in St. Louis?
Well, it's had two effects. One of them is sort of a deterioration of the public schools, because for the most part, these charter schools take the parents who are really motivated. They take the ones that are going to be in your PTAs and run your fundraisers. They take these active members out of the public school, and they go over to the charter schools, And so you don't have as good a parent base back in the regular public schools. They don't take as many handicapped kids. They don't take the homeless kids. So you're left with all of the really more difficult kids to deal with are left in the public schools. And so what you see is the public schools have a very, very difficult time keeping up their test scores, keeping up their attendance rates, and all of the other things that the state wants them to be judged on. And the charter schools, who haven't had a very good record of even surviving, of the first 37 charter schools that were formed in Kansas City and St. Louis in the first 10 years, 17 of them failed. So you have a failure rate of these charter schools of 40%. And so not only do they not perform well, they fail, and those kids are left wide open.
Are there any charter schools in other areas of Missouri, such as Springfield or somewhere else?
Not right now. There can be in those school districts that have been declared, like Normandy and Riverview Gardens over here. And I'm not sure if there's another one in Kansas City. There are some that are out state that have been declared unaccredited. They can be formed in those districts.
Okay. How are charters really privatizing as a privatizing screen?
Well, they say that they're public schools, but they're public only in that they do go after, you know, the children that are public school students, and they do get public money. But again, as I said before, they are really private schools run by private corporations. And even though we say they're non-profit, well, it's sort of like I run my own business, okay? And I am the sole proprietor, so I technically don't make a profit. It's all my income, and if you look at my profit and loss statement, you'll see nothing there. You'll see it go totally to my income. Same way with these people who run a charter school. They don't make a profit on their bottom line, but that just gets all absorbed in administrative salaries. And the cost to run the building and the cost that the people who own these charter school companies make and charge those charter schools. So, you know, they're not going to show a profit, but they are for-profit entities.
Are there charter school elective boards anywhere that you know of?
None that I know of, and that of course has been one of the problems. You know, they keep saying that they're really, really efficiently run. Well, that's such a misnomer. Over here, the average administrative cost in the state of Missouri is 8%, and there are preciously few charter schools that are less than that. Matter of fact, there's only two over there in the Kansas City area, and you have ones like KIPP, which is 2.5 times the administrative cost, and De La Salle Charter Schools, 33% of the money at De La Salle over there in Kansas City goes to administrative costs. I'll tell you, any school district that spent 33% of their expense on administrative costs in the public sector, their superintendent would be fired and every school board member would be thrown out of office. But these guys keep going on. They basically average somewhere between 15% and 20%. That is 2 to 2.5 times as much for administrative costs in these charter schools as it is in regular public schools.
Okay. Lastly, what are the advantages of public education, and why have you fought so hard for public education?
They take everybody. All of God's children are allowed into our schools. As the superintendent over here, I live in Francis Howell School District, and one of the superintendents used to say, our commitment is to do to the best of our ability to educate any child that comes to our doorstep. And that is not true of the charter schools. They don't have hardly any of the homeless children. Over here in St. Louis, we have 21% of our kids are homeless, and yet many of the local charter schools have none. They're lucky some of them will get up to 5%. They have about, nationwide, they have about 40% more of the handicapped children in public schools than they do in charter schools. And not only that, the kids that they have that are handicapped are the more resource-intensive kids, whereas the charter schools will take the easier, less disruptive ones, like the ones that are hard of hearing, the ones that have speech impediments, those kids that are much easier to manage. And even then, they don't have anywhere near the number of kids that the charter schools do. They don't take the kids that are in gangs. They don't take the kids whose parents are drug dealers. They don't take the kids who are in the foster system, or the kids who just came out of juvenile detention. Those kids have to go to some place. They go back to the public schools. They don't get into private schools. And then on top of that, after the charter schools do accept some of these kids, they have the right to call them out. They have the right to say, sorry, you didn't meet our criteria, bye-bye, and they kick them back to the public schools.
Thank you. Now, where can people find out about your organization? Do you have an email, a website?
We're on Facebook, and it's called Missouri Public School Advocates. And if you go and find that in Facebook, and that's where we try and post things. Our website is in the midst of being reconstructed, but if they go there, you can start to follow what we're doing. And we're just trying to speak out about public schools, because all this really is, if you look at it, the people that are funding this are people like Rex Singfield, who is a billionaire here in Missouri, and the Koch brothers, and all these other people that want private schools to be funded. Their ultimate goal in all of this is to get funding for their private schools, because they keep making out the public schools as not capable of educating all the students, so we need to have this choice. And what that really means is there's approximately 120,000 students here in Missouri that are either going to parochial schools or private schools or being homeschooled, and they want the $11,000 worth of money for every one of those students. So they're looking to take about $1.3 billion out of our tax rolls away from our public schools and put them into private schools like Kansas City Rockhurst, or like over here DeSchmidt or CBC or Country Day or Mary I, so that they can have their money. This all gets back to Milton Friedman, who was the Nobel economist who started all this back in 1955, when he wrote a paper and said that the only role in government in terms of education is to collect money, and that money should in turn go to a voucher to everybody, and then everybody pick their own private school. And it's interesting to note that he did that 1 year after Brown versus Board of Education, and he did it so a lot of these people could get out of schools that take everybody, so they could go to their own private school and discriminate. And that's exactly what charter schools do and private schools. I don't mind private schools discriminating. That's fine. They pay their own way. But they want that money, and that's what they're after.
Well, thank you, Carl Peterson. I really appreciate your telling us all this, and I'm right with you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and you guys have a good evening over there in Kansas City.
All right, thank you. Again, my name is Lon Swearingen, and our guest was Carl Peterson, president of Missouri Advocates for Public Schools. Thank you for listening tonight, and I'll close with this quotation by Henry Adams, historian: "A teacher affects eternity."
Amino acids land on barren rock and promptly adopt the character of protein. Bacteria makes the scene, and a chain reaction begins, Interstellar travel of space-proof info packets like these are cast far and wide, journey throughout the infinite sky we call the universe.
A special double shot of From Arc to Microchip this Thursday at 7 p.m.
When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang and wore my corduroy. Everybody said I did it only to annoy, but I was gonna be an engineer. Mama said to me, why can't you be a lady? Your duty is to make me the mother of a pearl. Wait until you're older, dear, and maybe you'll be glad that you're a girl.
Hi, this is Hester Dusick, retired CWA 6360. And today we have a special guest that will bring back some memories for some of us. And her name is Jessica Newworth, and she is she has written a book. It's called Equal Means Equal. And she was in Kansas City in August, and many of us were able to hear her speak then. And she does, her book just came out in January. She's the founder of the international women's rights organization Equality Now. And she's the former director of New York branch of the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. And we welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you, Hester.
Tell me, your book is so popular. Your speaking engagement, I think, was probably a sellout. What is it I know it's time. It's time for us to revisit the Equal Rights Amendment. Many have thought that it was already passed. And can you tell me why now? Because it's been laying dormant for a long time, since 82?
82 is when the deadline expired, and it has been laying dormant, and we're trying to bring it back. Last year, we started the ERA Coalition, and we're just picking up steam right and left. I think... many people, I just missed the last ERA campaign. I was in college when that deadline expired. And I'm talking to a lot of people younger than me, both women and men. They have no idea what the ERA is. When we tell them what it is, they think it already passed or it must already be in the Constitution. They just don't realize that it isn't. And when they realize that it isn't, they're kind of shocked, and they just don't see why it shouldn't be. It's in most countries in the world, a provision that just guarantees fundamental right to sex equality. So I think why now? A lot has changed in the last 40 years. Our culture has changed. Our laws have changed. And I think that many of the arguments, when you look back at them now, they just seem silly. You know, unisex bathrooms seems to have been a really big fear that people had. And now everybody's ridden on a plane or a train is very used to that. I think fear of women in the military was another huge fear that was mobilized to try to stop the ERA. And now women really want to be in the military. They want to be in combat. They have the right to be in combat pretty much established at this point. And I don't think that is an argument against the ERA anymore. So we're looking back. And then, of course, one of the big arguments that was really like the specter of doom at that time was the prospect of gay marriage. And now that's a constitutional right. So I think the ERA is kind of behind in many ways, and our thinking is it's really a no-brainer at this point. It's just that, as you said, it's sort of fallen off the radar screen, and we need to bring it back.
Well, I think, too, if you look at the map, you'll see that most of those states who did not, if not all of them that didn't pass it, were former Confederate states. And Kansas did pass it. Missouri did not. But when you look at that cluster and you have a different mindset. And I can remember as a young woman being told, why do you want equal rights? We already put you on a pedestal. As if being equal rights was going to be a step down. And that was a very big mindset. That was before women were allowed in former traditional men's jobs. I mean, it was total upheaval. And Communication Workers of America came to Kansas City for their convention every 3 years when they were redoing their contract. They thought Kansas City was lucky for them. That went on for decades until we did not pass it in Missouri. They refused to come back and said they would not come back with their convention until we had it passed in Missouri. I wasn't aware it came up every year. I really wasn't.
Well, when I talk to people who led that campaign in the 70s and early 80s, they tell me that actually it came so close. It was 35 out of 38 states that ratified, so there were just three states missing. And people tell me that it was literally a handful of votes that would have made the difference. And if there hadn't been a deadline, I have no doubt that we would already have the ERA today.
I wonder how much of this is economic, and I do remember the days. I think people still are concerned. They don't want, if you were pregnant, you did not want your boss to know, because you probably were going to get sent home, or there'd be a reason, or there'd be they'd give you work that you couldn't do, so you did it to yourself.
And that's still a problem. I mean, I think when we look at the law and we look at some of the constitutional cases, pregnancy discrimination really has not been recognized by the Supreme Court as sex discrimination. The way they saw it when they last looked at it, it was like, because men couldn't get pregnant, then there couldn't be sort of pregnancy discrimination on the basis of sex. If there were pregnant men and pregnant women and pregnant men and women were treated differently, you know, then it would be discrimination. And I just think that's so outdated. I don't think even at the time it made sense to the justices who dissented in that decision. Didn't make sense to Congress, who pretty immediately after that decision passed the Pregnancy Discrimination Act in an effort to correct that decision. But it's still the case today under the law that if you have a disability, a workplace is required to make reasonable accommodation for you. But if you're pregnant, you can get fired for taking too many bathroom breaks, for keeping a water bottle handy and drinking on the job water. And, you know, there are people who have lost their jobs because of these restrictions and have been forced to seek public assistance because they just don't have the same legal right to reasonable accommodation of their pregnancy that people with disabilities have under the disabilities law. So I think we feel like the ERA could be very helpful in requiring employers to make reasonable accommodation for women in the workplace in the same way that they're required to make reasonable accommodation for people with disabilities. It would just give us a constitutional basis for these types of claims. And also work reassignment. It's not just accommodation. I think recently many people might have heard about the case that went to the Supreme Court against UPS brought by a young woman called Peggy Young. And Peggy Young was forced out of work during her pregnancy because she didn't do a lot of heavy lifting, but her job legally required her to be able to do more than 20 pounds, and that's something her doctor said she shouldn't do. So then legally UPS felt they couldn't keep her in that job, and they didn't refuse to reassign her to another job. Now that same UPS has a policy that if you are driving off the job and you are a driver for UPS and end up losing your license because of drunk driving or your license is suspended, you have a right to temporary reassignment to jobs that don't involve driving during the time your license is suspended. So all that accommodation is made for drunk drivers, but not for pregnant women. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, it makes sense in their minds. I'm looking at this, and the statistics are that women are, is it still true, 47% of the paid workers in this country are women, and that women make up 64% of the minimum wage workers. Now, that 47% seems low to me, but that's because that's paid. How much of our work is volunteer?
That's true, too. That's true, too. And, of course, we all know this figure is 78 cents on the dollar that women make for every dollar that a man makes. And that's gone up maybe from 59 cents in the ERA campaign days, but it's certainly not close enough to a dollar, and that's the overall average. Of course, women of color make significantly less than the 78 cents. So I think we really have a long way to go, and we need a legal framework that will help us get there. Right now, you know, even on the issue of pay inequity, there are legal obstacles that women face when they find out that someone else, a man on the job, same job, is making more than they are. Even though we have laws in place like the Equal Pay Act and Title VII, they don't work because there are loopholes, and you know, I'd be happy to go into those, but what we see is again and again cases of women coming in clearly making less for the same work, not getting relief in the courts, and that's holding us all back.
There was a businessman that he ran a factory here in Kansas City, and my mother worked there. And when the women would go to him and ask him for a raise, they'd get nickel raises. I mean, this is in the 70s. And but the men who worked there, who they didn't work hard, and they always got like a quarter raise. And when the women came to him and said, "Why are you doing this?" He said, "Well, that's because the men are the heads of the household." And they're saying, "But I'm the head of my household. I have children." But it didn't make any difference. His bias was that a man would always get more and not the women, although the women really worked hard.
Well, you know, if you look more recently at the Walmart case that also went up to the Supreme Court, I mean, there was a lot of evidence there that was introduced by some of the women who worked in Walmart, where they would go in, and it was pretty much the same thing. They would ask for a raise, and their boss would say, "You know what, you don't need the money." And they'd say, "How come this guy is doing the same job and making more?" "Well, he has a family." So that's not such an old story. That's an ongoing, continuing story. And in that case, which is another sad case, Betty Dukes brought over the course of 10 years, tried to bring a class action against Walmart. And the Supreme Court basically said, even if there's a pattern, which there is, let's say there is, in every single of the thousands of Walmart stores across the country of lower pay for women and a slower rate of promotion, that still wouldn't be enough to bring this class action. And I just think, why not? That just seems like clear-cut evidence, but, you know, there's kind of corporate culture that was at stake. You know, it just wasn't like, unless there's a smoking gun memo that said, "Let's pay women less," the court wouldn't take that as a class action.
I read through some of this information. I was thinking, probably what will be very helpful with pushing this through is by joining forces and having men support us when they certainly were not supporting us last time very much. And since this, your organization seems to, if I'm understanding correctly, you have offices globally. Is that correct?
No, we have an office in Washington.
Okay.
You may be thinking of Equality Now, which was how I got into the women's movement through the international work of Equality Now. But the ERA Coalition is an organization that we started last year. It's based in Washington, but we have growing members, organizational members, individual supporters all across the country, and quite a lot of celebrities have come on, and I have to say quite a lot of men. And we have one group that started a Facebook campaign, Boys and Men for the ERA, which is fun, and I think there is a big difference now. We will have a lot and do already have lots of men who support the ERA, and also it makes a difference in their lives. I mean, men who struggle to get parental leave rights, which they aren't able to always take, and I think are doing more and more in the family and beginning to sort of suffer the same kind of work-life balance issues that women are so familiar with.
I think that maybe our sons, because I have a son, 36, and our nephews, I think they've listened to us enough over the years and at home to know, and they have their mothers. They're watching their mothers work. I think that we have a whole group that we can get to support us now. Where last time I can remember when in the 60s when if you wanted birth control pills, you only got a couple of months before you got married, and you had to have your husband sign that you could get them, and you had if a woman wanted to have, if she had 10 kids and she wanted to have her tubes tied, the husband had to sign it. The paper,
yeah, I remember
giving
that too.
Permission.
I mean, I think we're running into a lot of outrage, which we can channel into strategic political action. But I have to say, maybe the most outraged group of people that I run into are the fathers who have young daughters entering the workplace, and they just get so angry when they see their daughters treated less well than men in the same workplace. And I think that it's just interesting because maybe the mothers are more familiar with all of this. Like, yeah, I know, that's how it is. And I think the fathers are just not really ready to stand by and do nothing when they see that kind of discrimination in their own family, for their own family.
I see what you're talking about because in other fields, they are still where the men make more women, even in professional, than the women. And I see now that the dads are starting to have that put in front of them, and it's a different story.
Yeah.
It's a wake-up call.
Absolutely.
What do you think has been most effective?
Well, I think just it's really like we're trying to close an information gap. The most effective thing is you know, with help from shows like yours, to really just let people know we actually don't have this, and we should. And I think that once people know that, if they just go onto our website at eracoalition.org, they can look up their state, put in your zip code. You can find out where does your congressional representative stand on the ERA. And if, you know, if they're not a co-sponsor of any of the ERA-related legislation, just click and write to them. We have so many campaign tools that we never had 40 years ago, like the Internet and social media. So I think social media has been particularly helpful.
Well, and our women are stronger now. I mean, they've had to fight for everything they got. But I think that they are more in tune. It's not simply they have to go home immediately and fix dinner, do what they're doing. And they have their own cars. I can remember when there was only one car per family.
Mm-hmm.
So they're much, I mean, that may not have been in a bigger city. Of course, you have great public transportation, but you would be really isolated. So I think wonderful opportunities. Now, are there states who have actual offices or something with the ERA coalition?
Well, we're just starting. We have no funds, so we're desperately looking for help in all kinds of ways. And in the absence of the funds that we would need to really have offices, we have a really amazing group of volunteers in different parts of the country. People are just emerging and starting to play a leadership role. So we hope to have more offices. But right now, we really just have a very tiny outpost in Washington, D.C.
Well, I think that you're going to have some growing pains pretty fast. And I know that our listeners are pretty active. We have all walks of life, many of them activists, and we'll have it on your website on for the Heartland Labor Forum, so they'll be able to access that. And we archive our shows for a year, so I'm going to call on all of my friends and especially my labor women, and I think we have a task ahead of us. If you get the chance, please go get Jessica's book because it's a popular one. It's got great information, and we need to update our statistics, and that was equal means equal. And check your library, check your wherever it is that you get your books. Please check and see if they have it. If they don't, ask them for it. So, Jessica, I just can't tell you how much I've appreciated the information that you brought to us. And
well, thanks. I mean, thanks for bringing it to your listeners. And I just want to add again in that website, eracoalition.org, because that's the action component. The book will tell you why we need it. And that website will help you join the movement to get it.
Well, I'm going to get a hold of my daughter and her friends, and we have a new project this year. So I
do. Sounds good. Let's get it done.
Thank you very much for your hard work.
Thank you.
Hopefully we have Mark Grunberg on the phone. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks very much.
Oh, good. All right. Well, we've had some real technical problems for the last few minutes. And unfortunately, I don't think we can play our interview with Jessica Neuwirth about the Equal Rights Amendment because of an equipment failure. So we got some time. Let's talk about what's new. We were going to talk about the presidential campaign, huh? Everybody else is, right?
And since we talked, I've picked up some more information about endorsements or okay. non-endorsements, as the case may be. So
let's review some of the endorsements. First off, which unions have already endorsed?
Okay, all the endorsements so far have been on the Democratic side. For Bernie Sanders, the only union that has endorsed is the National Nurses United, which is 175,000 members, both in the Midwest, in Massachusetts, and mostly in California. For Hillary Clinton, there are now five unions. There's the painters, there's the plumbers, there's the teachers, there's the bricklayers, and I'm trying to remember who
the
number
roofers.
Five is. Give me a few minutes. I'll think of it. And
it's the roofer, Mark. It's the roofers.
The roofers is number five. Yes. Those last three construction building trades unions have come in just within the last couple of days.
Actually, I think there's another one, and that's the machinist.
Machinists, yes. Okay, so that makes six. Yes, because there were six in the political story. And speaking of the political story, two big unions decided to put off their endorsements. And these are two unions who are both notable for their size and notable for the fact that they are majority female. And they are the service employees and AFSCME. AFSCME had its board meeting this past week, but they decided to keep their endorsement process among their members going. SEIU, which in 2008 endorsed Barack Obama in February and gave him a big boost in the union in the labor movement, again decided that they weren't finished. They wanted to hear more from their members before they went ahead with an endorsement. One thing that should be noted about this, part of this is a reaction to the flack that AFT has been getting from some of its rank and file after it made a very early endorsement of Secretary Clinton. The stuff you see on Twitter, the stuff you see on email, the stuff you see on all the other social media is saying, why did you do it? This is too early.
This is Ariana Echo with the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, September 24th, 2015.
Yeah, you noticed that.
First anniversary commemoration of the disappearance of 43 students in Mexico, Saturday, September 26th, 4 to 10 p.m. at Vacant Farm. Black and Brown Lives Matter, Dr. Teresa Torres at Community of Reason, Sunday, September 27th at 1 p.m. at the UMKC Hague Hall, Room 301. Empower Missouri Monthly Lunch, Spent Looking for Change. Reverend Leah M. McIntosh, Senior Manager, CCO, will present a video and discussion of harmful lending schemes and ways to change them on Friday, October 2nd, 11:30 to 1 at the Westport Flea Market. Afro-Indigenous Hondurans and Resistance, the U.S. Drug War, Violent Displacement and Migration, Sunday, October 4th at 5 p.m., Black Archives of Mid-America. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee Monthly Meeting, Tuesday, October 6th, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the All Souls Unitarian Church. Second Annual Community Forum on Gun Violence, October 12th, at the Kauffman Conference Center. Alliance for Retired Americans Annual Gerald Randall Luncheon honoring Representative Judy Morgan, on Wednesday, October 14th, 11 a.m. at the Argosy Casino.
And that's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called No Longer Our Walmart, and Should Police Unions Be in the House of Labor? Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. She's a noble character.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.